Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Dietta. You can participate in this discussion by calling toll-free 877-300-7645. As we continue this review of what the Roman Catholic Church was confronting as it relates to this tribunal, if you will, this coming before a world agency for the first time to have to, based upon their commitment to participate in the rights of the child, to actually answer questions at the highest level. We recognize that before the Roman Catholic Church would even submit to appearing, they required 6 months written notice by the United Nations to send a request for all documents that were desired, as well as to submit all questions that would be asked 6 months in advance. The Roman Catholic Church refused to send the documents that were requested and then did not answer the vast majority of the questions, even with 6 months lead time to prepare. The submissions on behalf of the international community reference Vatican documents that show that its officials knew that these events were taking place, that it wasn't a case of casual events taking place, that the Roman Catholic Church didn't have the ability to know precisely what its priests were doing. But all local documentation shows that the local leaders in countries knew precisely what was happening and had a precise strategy for handling it. And in the case of the Los Angeles Archdiocese, it was a issue where they not only knew, but there were letters from American clerics in the as high as the cardinal level, Cardinal Mahoney, for example, in Los Angeles, that wrote letters repeatedly to Ratzinger, the man who became Pope, the man who put himself in a position where he was the lead obstacle worldwide for holding pedophile priests accountable, begging for him to do something and not to continue to endorse this policy of a cover-up and moving the priests to other parishes where they could continue to molest other children. We know these things. The Roman Catholic Church has only provided documents when ordered by the courts and never at the highest level. I mean, there's letters from Mahoney and cardinals to other cardinals in the Vatican who became Pope, but never their response, because the Vatican always declares diplomatic immunity and says we're not going to become accountable in this regard. For too many years, this is a quote, survivors were the ones speaking out about this and bearing the brunt of a lot of criticism. A human rights attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights protested, which provided a key report to the committee. She says, and so this is a very important moment for many, many people who are here in Geneva and around the world who will be watching the Holy See to see if for the first time they actually answer these questions. But guess what? They didn't. Indeed, to date, the Roman Catholic Church has never defended its record to any large extent or in any court, and it has successfully argued that it is immune from lawsuits as a sovereign state, and that regardless, bishops were responsible for the pedophile priests and their care, not the Pope or his policies. This is to say that the priests who represent the Roman Catholic Church, who are ordained by the Roman Catholic Church, are not representing the Roman Catholic Church. You know, try that as a business sometime. To say, you know, my employee did that. We had a policy not to do that. We trained our employees not to do that. This person did it. Don't hold me accountable for the acts of my employee. Try that sometime in a court. See how well it works for you. And the other thing that's just repulsive here is that Roman Catholicism is a religion. And yet, because it has this tiny little postage stamp of a pagan realm called the Vatican, that it pretends it's a state, that it takes a political status. Political or you're religious? Which one? We have Nick on the phone who's called into the Shattering Myths on many times in the past, but we haven't heard from you, Nick, in a good long while. I hope you're okay, my friend.
I'm okay. I'm listening to your podcast usually, so I'm just downloading weeks worth of podcasts and listening in 1-2 days.
Okay. Well, great.
So in one of them podcasts, I heard how would you and Al-Sulwi what would you do with after the 9/11 happened? What would you do to, you know, mm-hmm. in retaliation? Mm-hmm. Now the question I have, like, what if one of Catholics or Christians would fly those planes into either America's mm-hmm. center or even a Muslim center and would scream instead of Allahu Akbar, in the name of God, for the Lord Jesus Savior. What would you bomb then? What would we then? I mean,
that's a good comparison. Let me answer that. If the perpetrators yelling Allahu Akbar, Allah is most great. If they had corrupted their religion, and they were doing so as just individuals without any connection to the tenets of the religion, had committed that act, then dropping leaflets over the Kaaba so that the people would get out of the way and then destroying the Kaaba would have been inappropriate as part of a response. But the case is in Islam that Muhammad was a terrorist. That Islam is a terrorist dogma. That according to the Quran and Hadith, the fundamental documents that comprise this religion, you can't be a Muslim unless you're a terrorist. So in this case, the religion itself is solely responsible for the acts of the perpetrators. In the case of a Roman Catholic deciding that they were going to commit a terrorist act on behalf of their church, the church's own internal canon or law, nor the Christian New Testament, neither would give them authorization to do so. They would have corrupted their religion to perpetrate the act, where in the case of Islam, it's their religion that corrupted them. So we have an opposite set of circumstances with Islam. The facts underline the terrorist act show that Islam is responsible in the case of 9/11, and on your hypothetical attack, there would be no evidence to tie Roman Catholicism with the act of terrorism. So they're night and day different.
Okay. Now, well, another question. You know, Al-Su have accent, and mm-hmm. Most of what he's saying, I understand. Mm-hmm. However, would you repeat to me where did the Allahu Akbar came from? But what Al-Su said, not your version, because I already know, you know, the story.
Okay,
he said something about that Muhammad was actually not the first one who came up with Al-Akbar. And I want to know, what did he say? Because I didn't...
Okay. Yeah, first of all, as it relates to the statement made by Muslims when they commit terrorist acts, we are in complete agreement because the facts are irrefutable. You know, Allahu Akbar was first shouted by Muslims because Muhammad told them to do so as they were about to terrorize the Jewish farming community of Kabar. So in that regard, we have no difference whatsoever. There are two areas where we actually do not have a disagreement, but where IQ al-Rasuli has added some additional information to help us understand Allahu Akbar. What he said is that Allahu Akbar was not actually an original statement by Muhammad, although its implications for Islamic terrorism fall to Muhammad's feet. But Muhammad copied almost every aspect of Islam from his pagan ancestors. And this idea that the black stone in the Kaaba was Akbar, that it was older, that it was bigger, and that it was greater than the other idols, was something that was promoted by pagans regarding the Kaaba for generations before Muhammad. So what he was saying is just the history of the Kaaba, which had 360 pagan gods and goddesses, all represented by stones, that the black stone that represented the pagan god Allah was older, was bigger, and was considered greater than the other stones. And so he was plagiarizing part of his pagan past. The other aspect that IQ adds is that, well, most people consider Akbar to mean Allah is greater or Allah is most great. Being a student of Arabic, IQ al-Rasuli has correctly pointed out that its primary meaning is really older, like the eldest son would be Akbar in his family. And if you had two rocks side by side and one rock was bigger than the other rock, the bigger rock would be Akbar. And
you
so
know, all that, I understand all of that and I remember all of that.
Okay.
You said something about the veil, something where Allah Akbar have something to do with the veil. I don't know what veil, and I couldn't really understand anything before that veil.
Yeah, you know, Nick, I don't recall that. If I did, I would certainly try to share it with you. When we have IQ back on, I will ask him if he can elaborate. In fact, I'll even send him an email. And if you have additional questions, please hang on, Nick. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Nick calling in from Wisconsin. I think, Nick, the fact that you've held on suggests that you had another question or two. Go ahead.
Let me first set the stage for the next question, which is
okay.
About Torah. If I tell my kids, don't touch the fire,
mm-hmm.
And I'll ask why, I can give them two kinds of explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm your father and I love you and I will not tell you to do something that will, and I'm telling you to do something that will, you know, hurt you or will not hurt you and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
Or
keep you from harm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Or I can also tell them that if you will touch it, you will get burned.
Mm-hmm.
And in
you're explaining the reason, you're getting the consequence if they touch the fire. So you're providing them with the consequence in advance. And the other, you're not providing them with the consequence. You're just saying, don't do this because you need to trust me. I'm looking out for your best interests, but you don't give them a reason. Is that the difference between the two?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
So, when Torah says do not eat bacon, why?
Yeah, it doesn't actually.
Because
yeah.
God said so?
No, it didn't actually. It doesn't actually say that. What it says is that eating swine, eating pig, is pork is not good for you. That's what it says, is that it lists the things that it says, here's the things that are good for you to eat, and it says those things are good for you to eat, and then it lists things that are bad for you to eat, and it says that these things are not healthy, these are not good for you to eat. And as it turns out, while he did not provide the reason, because the reason would have been very complicated for people of that age to understand. I mean, the reason for swine in particular is that which they consume. They're very comfortable eating garbage, and their stomach does not process that which they consume in a way to render the meat safe. And also, pork has traditionally been the meat that has been the most susceptible to pathogens. And because the flesh of swine is so similar to human flesh, it's the easiest form of meat that will convey a pathogen from an animal to a human. And so those were the four specific reasons. He just said, this is not healthy for you. He didn't give you the reason. He just said, this is not healthy for you to eat. And if you look at the things that were on the seafood menu, for example, where he said, you know, eat seafood with gills which would leave out things like the sea roach, which is the lobster and shrimp and clams and mussels, they're all filtering animals. They consume the poisons and the waste products of the ocean, and so, you know, universally he was using the first of your two examples, which is to say, I know what's best for you. You should eat these things. You shouldn't eat these because these are not good for you.
Mm.
Now, the symbolic meaning of it is actually far more important. The symbolic meaning is that if we as individuals consume poison, if we consume that which isn't good for us, like, you know, we're willing to embrace religious or political ideals, and we lap that stuff up, as most people do, that, you know, it's going to have a negative effect on us. You know, garbage in, garbage out.
Well, so, I mean, the shrimp and others, them are mm-hmm. bottom feeders, yeah. But
yes.
Back then, there was no garbage no garbage that...
Oh, sure. Sure, there is. Yeah, there absolutely. First of all, not only was there pollution back there, human pollution, but the shrimp and lobsters and the like, they are the ocean's cleaning system. You know, because not only is there runoff into the oceans from the land, but also, you know, fish have a full cycle in their input and output. Animals, you know, sea animals die and their bodies decompose. You know, for example, when we've had the deep sea probes and they've looked at the large presence of clams and not clams but of crabs and shrimp in the deep oceans, they will immediately devour a dead carcass just the way that vultures do. And vultures were not on the list because they eat dead meat as well, decomposing meat as well. So that was their diet, and that diet's not good for us to eat those that eat that. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we return and attempt to conclude our review of Roman Catholicism and the fix that it has put itself in by not only allowing its priests to molest little children, but deliberately covering up the acts so that it could maintain its reputation. We have a good friend of the program, Nick, who's calling in from Wisconsin, catching up on questions. And so, Nick, the floor is yours. Go ahead.
I'm sorry if I'm being annoying.
You're not. No, I like, you know, Nick, you're one of my favorite callers, and I've missed the fact that I haven't heard from you in a while, and so, no, I'm glad that you're called. Your question on the two ways, for example, in our last segment, that a father can provide instruction. One is to show to tell the consequence. The other is to say, listen, I know a lot about things that you don't know a lot about, and so I'm just going to tell you that this isn't good for you. God does both.
While you presented the reasoning for mm-hmm. people of those ages not to eat all those bad things,
mm-hmm.
Fast forward to this stage, this time, if I'm a farmer and I will exclude all those bad things that make a pork unhealthy for humans, which garbage or
feeding them corn as opposed to garbage.
Feeding them something and keep them
healthy
because they have skin like ours and keep them not being hurt or
test them for trichinosis.
Why would I not eat them if they
That is a beautiful question, and I am really glad you asked it. What it does is that, and the answer here is going to point out the difference between the correct way to observe the Torah and the incorrect way to observe the Torah. The incorrect way is the rabbinical religious way, which views the Torah as a set of laws that must be obeyed. And so if you view the instruction from our father saying, you know, that pork is not good for you, and until the last 50 years, it was really good advice. It wasn't good for me. And you're more likely to get sick going and eating shellfish than you are anything else you could eat now today at a restaurant or when you buy food. And so the advice he gave was really good. And the last 50 years, we have resolved many of the problems. And so if you were law obedient, as the religious interpretation goes, then you just wouldn't do it because you're being obedient to a law that you don't understand why. If you are Torah observant in the sense that I'm Torah observant, which is that I observe the Torah, I look at the Torah as guidance, as teaching, which is what the word means, and I observe it in the sense of closely examining and carefully considering it. Now, if you're Torah observant from the perspective that God wants us to be Torah observant, which is to examine and consider, then your hypothetical here is absolutely valid. And, for example, I will occasionally have baby back ribs, and when I was in Maine, I considered the local cuisine. And it did not affect my relationship with one iota. So you can be Torah observant and understand why God provided the instruction and benefit from it, and yet not be legally bound to obey a law, because Torah doesn't mean law, and Hebrew doesn't even have a word for obey. So in your situation... Yeah, it's. I've been known to do it. Didn't feel guilty the least bit about it, and understood why it was there and what it means spiritually to me today. And so, I think that's a really good question.
So then, it's okay for me to do all those things, just not to eat those things like every day.
Yeah, you know, it's. I'm really uncomfortable in this position because. God did design us. He knows about how we work better than we do. But certainly it appears that his advice regarding this is not healthy for you was and continues to be valid. It's just that the risk today on eating shellfish, for example, is much less than it was then. Now, there are some things on the list which are still problematic. You don't want to make a diet of a vulture. You're much better off eating chicken than you are vulture. And you got to be really careful when you eat clams and mussels, because they still have a tendency to get people sick. And I can tell you, I've had shrimp in the past where I took a bite and I said, I know this one's bad, and man, I got sicker than a dog.
But I'm not going to be excluded from the family if I have
only
occasionally bacon and
that is correct. Bread. You know, this is the absolutely not. And the thing about the Torah is that it provides five conditions to participate in the covenant. Once you accept those five conditions, no matter what you do, you are not going to be excluded from the family. The Torah isn't a document that's designed to say, you know, Nick, you screwed up that one time, so you're out of here. The Torah is designed to say, hey, Nick, you're a flawed individual. Yada, you're a flawed individual. And so I have created a plan that enables you to survive your flaws and to be part of my family. And once you accept those five conditions of the covenant, then you're a beneficiary, and therefore you are liberated, if you will, exonerated, so then, vindicated from your flaws.
So then same reasoning can be applied to circumcision because today's medical industry are really good in keeping me healthy. If I don't circumcise myself, then...
No, it can't. Now, Let me explain why. In the case of the food, all God said is these things are not healthy for you to eat. It's not a salvation issue. He does not tie anything related to a relationship with Him or your salvation to what you eat. He just said simply not healthy for you. Circumcision, along with the four other requirements of the covenant, are absolute requirements to be part of the covenant. God
said, like a marking, right?
Yeah, God said emphatically that circumcision is the sign of the covenant, and that parents are to circumcise their sons on the eighth day, and that if you are not circumcised, you cannot be part of the covenant. You can't benefit from Pesach. Pesach is the means for eternal life, which means at the end of your mortal existence, you're going to cease to exist if you're not circumcised as a male. And he said emphatically that one of the greatest crimes ever promoted in his name was this idea that circumcised males could enter his home in heaven. And he says
So then again, I hear because I said so.
No, God was explicit in explaining each of the five requirements to participate in the covenant. And those, when you accept those five conditions for participating in the covenant, then God makes you immortal, He perfects you, He saves you, and the like. He went to great lengths to explain the consequence of not being circumcised. He went to great lengths explaining the meaning of being circumcised. And he talked about everything you could possibly want to know about how circumcision was your commitment, your sign that you, as a parent, were going to raise your children to be members of God's family, which he thinks is the single most important thing that that you can do. And how?
Well, maybe sometime in the future you could make one of the shows and say, tell us a little more about circumcisions and stuff.
Sure. In fact, we actually did a series of two or three programs entirely on circumcision, and a good friend of mine has done a series entirely devoted to everything we can know about circumcision. I think I have done two as well, but I will be glad to represent it, because circumcision is one of the five requirements of the covenant. And God's not saying that you, Nick, or anyone else has to be circumcised. He's saying if you are a male and you want to be part of His covenant family, then you need to be circumcised. So the requirement to be circumcised is one of the five requirements to be part of the covenant.
Yeah, unless I find those archives or hear and understand, then I would take it as a blackmail. Unless I understand, then
no, because to blackmail means that you have that to blackmail someone, you have to know something that they have done that if known would cause that individual considerable shame or harm.
Okay, blackmail was the wrong term.
Yeah, so blackmail is the wrong term.
Yeah.
And God's gave you mortal life. He gave you a free will, and He gave you a nesama, which is our conscience, which is our ability to discern right from wrong. And He gave you His Torah teaching. And so He's saying, I gave you these things. You can choose to do whatever you want with them. You can squander them, and there's no consequence or no penalty. Or you can choose to act upon them. And He says, here's, if you want to live forever with Me in heaven, these are the five things that I asked of you. If you're willing to do these five things, I will provide you with the opportunity to live with Me in heaven.
Well, I was trying to say is I would love to do that, but right now, but it would be done out of fear that I will not be accepted. And that's not the way.
The fact is, there should be no fear, because the consequence of not being circumcised as a male is simply that at the end of your mortal existence, you'll get your life and every choice and every opportunity that is afforded to you in life. And at the end of your life, you're just simply going to cease to exist. If God were to say, you either do what I say, or I'm going to make certain that you are tortured forever in hell, that would be something to fear. But God doesn't say that.
End of existence for some is worse than being tortured.
Just like every animal, you've got your life, and at the end of your life, there's just nothing more. So you've got everything that God gave you in terms of your mortal existence, and there'll be no consciousness after that point. Your consciousness simply ceases to exist. So there
is no punishment. Thank you for answering my questions.
Yeah, they were great ones, Nick.
Finish your presentation with the church and stuff.
Well, thank you, Nick. Wonderful questions.
Sometime later, then.
Thank you, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Shattering Myths will continue after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. And we only have 6 minutes in this segment, and I can't conclude the review of the Roman Catholic Church in that period of time. We're going to postpone our conclusion of Roman Catholicism and its meeting with the world governing body on its propensity to protect pedophiles and then to cover up the crime. We're going to place that with a little more discussion on circumcision, because I think Nick's line of questioning was really extraordinarily thoughtful. That's why I'm pleased that we continued to go back to Nick, because I think this is why he was originally asking about food. You know, with food, God simply says, this is good for you, this is not good for you. And he leaves it at that. There's nothing, he never once says, you know, boy, if you eat lobster, you're not coming into my house with that stench. Doesn't say that. He never says, hey, you know, if you eat shrimp, then you can't avail yourself of any one of my mikre, the first three being the most essential, because they speak of immortality, perfection, and adoption. Never says that. And it makes one statement, says, here's things that are good for you to eat, here's things that are not good for you to eat, and leaves it there. Now, there's a lot of things, by the way, in the Torah that you simply cannot do, but there's nothing in the Torah that you can't learn from. My favorite book in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is the 119th Psalm. For those that also listen in to the Shabbat scripture study that we have on Fridays after sunset, you'll know that we have devoted the last half a dozen programs to the 119th Psalm and will continue to do so for some time. The reason I mention the 119th Psalm is that it's devoted in its entirety to educating us as to how to properly observe the Torah. And so when I say that the difference between the way I observe the Torah and the way that a religious Jew would observe the Torah are night and day, the position that I've taken that is that to observe means to focus on, to closely examine, and to carefully consider. That happens to be the position that Dode, whom we know as David, was inspired to write in what is by far the longest psalm. The psalm, 119th Psalm, was devoted in its entirety to teaching us how to properly observe the Torah. And when we read the psalm, Dode is constantly talking about how we should observe, closely examine, and carefully consider what Yah conveyed to us in his Torah. He constantly tells us that the Torah is the document that he learned from. He constantly reinforces how we can transition from knowing to understanding by contemplating what God has provided to us as insights. And then he says there's four central aspects of the Torah that are the most important for us to focus on. He never once, in 176 statements regarding the Torah, ever mentions a single rule. He never brings up the Shabbat, never brings up diet, never brings up anything that you could remotely consider to be a rule. He just says there are four aspects of the Torah that are really important for us to consider. And among them are the means that Yahweh uses to resolve disputes, which would be the seven invitations to meet with him, the Mikra, the terms and conditions of the Torah itself, and the inscriptions that he inscribed that cut us into the relationship. He says, that's what you ought to focus on. Come to know those things, come to understand those things, and then he says, you'll be like me. He says, I know that that the doorway to heaven is wide open, that God himself couldn't keep me out because I'm coming holding a copy of the Torah. And so that's how I observe the Torah. I recognize there's lots of things in the Torah that I cannot do. I don't live in Yisrael. There's no temple at this time. Kohen, Loi, the Levite priests, don't exist anymore. At least they're unknown to us. And, you know, I live in America, not in Yisrael. So there's lots of things there I can't do. But there isn't anything in the Torah that I can't learn from. And so that's how I observe it. Now, moving on to circumcision. God was really clear in circumcision. He did not give the option, okay, I understand what this means, and therefore based upon understanding it and accepting it, based upon that spiritual understanding, we're good to go. Because he twice said that if you're a male, you've got to be circumcised of the spirit and of the flesh. Twice. So he's not giving you the out as a male to say, well, you know, I get it. Therefore, I'm going to rely on this symbolic understanding. He says, no. So you've got to be circumcised of the spirit and of the flesh. And he explains that circumcision is the sign of this covenant. And this covenant is limited to those who want to be part of my family. And it's the fifth requirement. Now, his actual instructions, though, are for parents to do this to his children.